When I returned from the trial, AR had the racing form spread out before him at the kitchen table. The cake this time was strawberry sponge with ladyfingers covered in whipped cream. One quart of milk had already been drained, the other was half full. AR's earlier comment about my still owing him really had rankled. I was no deadbeat. To prove it, I'd picked 5 or 6 warehouse locks. But the game, I said, watching him calculate the odds on the races, was becoming too risky. Other gangs were now on the lookout for me. He just shrugged and insisted I could handle it. Breaking free seemed to be the one card AR's deck was missing, so I asked, "When can we call it quits?" Without looking up, he replied, "You're part of the family." "Thanks, but I have one already." "Carolyn loves having you around." "So does my mom." Staring blankly at the newspaper, AR recounted a time in his life when his mother took his sister and his older brother Harry to San Francisco, leaving him and his younger brother at home. He had felt slighted. "Harry was everyone's favorite. My father was always comparing me to him. One night I crept into Harry's room in order to kill him, but I just stood there with the knife in my hand and the tears running down my face." Finally, AR looked at me. "Carolyn and I would really like you to stay." My throat tightened because I knew that he meant what he said, but a moment later the old AR returned. "You can't buy food with beer caps," he said, pushing the paper aside. "How much will it take to convince you to stay?"
"It's not the money."
"You got a future here, kid. Why be in such a hurry to join the working poor? I can see, Henny, you've been talking to the wrong people. Everyone will give you their 2 cents worth, but that ain't enough to live on." I met Susie in Times Square. On the telephone, I'd already told her as much as I knew about AR's fence. She did the rest, reaching out to her Harlem contacts. The only things I knew about Black Harlem had come from the papers. It was the largest Negro city in the world. It had the wildest nightclubs in New York, and it was short on housing and long on quacks, fortune tellers, and numbers players. I knew that betting on numbers was a national pastime, but until that moment, it had never crossed my mind to ask which numbers. AR looked at me with disbelief and explained the game. "First of all, you pick 3 numbers and put down some dough. The winning numbers are drawn from the day's totals of bank exchanges and bank balances. They're both announced daily by the clearinghouse and printed in the newspapers. Suppose," said AR, grabbing a pad and unscrewing the cap from his gold fountain pen, "the exchanges were $810,824,054, which he wrote down on the pad, and the balances $90,444,172. The winning numbers are the 7th and 8th numbers of the exchanges reading right to left, and the 7th number of the balances. Most people bet pennies, but some are in it for hundreds or even thousands of dollars. Each day, at least 1 million people around this country, maybe more, wait to learn the day's combination. It's the one word they live for." "Why not?" AR said, shrugging his shoulders and reaching for some of Carolyn's home-baked chocolate cookies. "Look at the payoff. A nickel gets you $30, a quarter, $150, 50 cents, $300. Sure, the chances of winning are slim, which is why I don't play, unless I know the numbers beforehand. But the stakes are 600 to 1. That ain't hay if you're able to collect, 'cause most times you can't. Which is why before long, gangsters will be replacing the amateurs. At least the mugs pay their bills." I asked AR for one of his business cards, which I stuffed in my pocketbook. At Times Square, I met Susie, and after hugs and kisses and tears, we boarded a 7th Avenue subway express heading north. Just as AR had predicted, we were stopped numerous times and asked if we wanted to bet on the numbers. A little girl, hopping from one foot to the other, insisted she could tell us the best way to find winning numbers. When Susie declined her offer,
The child shook her head and advised, "You can't hit 'em if you don't pull 'em."
"All right," said Susie, handing her a nickel. "Where can I find me a winner?"
The child replied in rhyme, "Look at someone's address. Write down your favorite hymn. Think of your shopping bill. Then just pick on a whim."
Susie let out a great hoot. She'd been taken, but didn't mind in the least. As we approached Jungle Alley, the name Susie gave a strip of joints on West 133rd Street between Lenox and 7th Avenue, I could have sworn that I saw Salvatore Zucanier, toting a briefcase, leave the alley, slide into the driver's seat of a black sedan, and pull away. A moment later, Susie and I followed the alley to a door with barred smoky windows. Susie knocked. A small slide opened and two eyes peered out, but the man said nothing. This was no ordinary nightclub where people streamed through the front door. It resembled a blind pig in which the bouncer won't open the door unless the customer says the right word.
"We're here to see Mr. Truffer," said Susie.
"Who sent you?"
"The man uptown," I said, handing him AR's business card. The slide was forcefully shut. For a minute, we just cooled our heels. Finally, the door opened, and a man built like a packing case ushered us through a carpeted hall leading to yet another door and another bouncer. Once having cleared the sentries, we saw resplendent before us colored lights playing slowly across the dance floor and stage of the club ball. To my amazement, the club was crowded with white swells, the high society tuxedo and evening gown crowd. It took a while before I got the lay of the land, but once I gauged the geometry, I could tell the Broadway types and celebrities and gangsters from the out-of-town visitors looking for excitement flavored with danger. Seated at a stage table were Jimmy Walker, George Raft, and Emily Vanderbilt. On stage, a brass combo, including the rapidly rising Louis Armstrong, was playing some sizzling jazz. The couples on the dance floor had lost all inhibitions as they swung and shimmied and shook to the suggestive moans of the music. Susie ordered a glass of white wine. The waiter brought a tray with glasses and plates and silverware, as well as a bottle of Riesling, two plates of cold cuts, cheeses, fruits, salted pretzels, and a bottle of champagne, which he opened expertly without losing a drop. "Compliments of the house," said the waiter, and handed me an engraved card with a note scrawled on the back in longhand. The printed side read, "Dear patron, here in the world's greatest city, it might amuse you to see the real inside of Harlem. You have heard it talked about, but few know its thrills. We are in a position to show you. Our guides, high yellows, tantalizing tans, and hot chocolates, will give you personal service. Until you have visited the genuine Harlem, you have not tasted the exotic black race. F. Truffer." On the other side of the card, someone had written, "Any friend of AR's is a friend of the house." When Susie read it, she said, "Ain't you a pip?" As the music played a final brassy up, down, and fade out, the stage show began. Two sisters tap danced to a Morse code routine. A diner would hand a question to one dancer who would then tap it out for her sister. The latter would then decipher the question and answer it with her own tap dancing. In this case, the question was, "Who killed Jesse James?" And the answer came back through taps. A member of his gang, one of his own. During the applause, our waiter handed us a note inviting us backstage to meet the owner of the club. Slipping between the closely placed tables, we followed the waiter to a door displaying a simple nameplate, Frederico Truffa, Odds and Ends. The waiter gave three short taps on a buzzer, told us to enter, and disappeared. At the far end of the room, over a paneled door and affixed to the wall, loomed a ship's figurehead. The image itself took the form of a woman with long braids curled at the end. Her upraised right hand held a torch, the left a sapling.
On her head sat a pointed helmet with horns. Naked from the waist up, she bared all her shapeliness. The room looked as if a hurricane had blown through it. Furniture was upended, drawers were open, papers littered on the floor, and an acrid odor permeated the air. On the floor, beside a large roll-top desk, lay a dead man, horrifically mutilated and burned. Susie and I immediately left the office. For a minute, we debated whether to call the cops, tell the head waiter, or just mind our own business. We chose to scram, even though doing so would make us look like suspects. A terrified Susie made directly for the train to Newark, and I returned to the Rothsteins. The next evening, Carolyn and A.R. went out to dinner. Alone in the house, I waited for the paper delivery. When it came, I found what I was looking for on the front page. Mr. Federico Truffer, the owner of the Club Ball in New York City, was found dead. A grisly murder. His wife, who had been gone for the day, reported that on her return to the club, she smelled burning flesh coming from her husband's office. Opening the door, she found him lying on the floor, completely naked, his arms and legs bound to spikes fastened to the boards. The body bore the marks of knife slashes and cigarette burns. Apparently, he had been tortured, but for what reason, the police are uncertain. Most horrible, his killer or killers had applied lit coals to his stomach. They were still smoldering when the police arrived, by which time the flesh and entrails had been burnt through. Almost immediately, the phone started ringing. First A.R. and then Hank. No, I knew nothing about the murder. Yes, the doors to the house were locked. Once I had a second to think, it occurred to me that I could hide, leave town, disappear. Frankly, I was scared, and A.R. knew it. He agreed that it was a good idea to get me out of the line of fire for a while, though I flinched when he used the word fire.